I'm Peggy Waymire with the World Vision Report. In Pakistan, more people flee the Swat Valley and head for refugee camps. But the camps might not be safe either.
During my time at Kachagari, I hear over and over again from the residents and some of the workers that there are Taliban in the camp. They came with their families and are exerting their influence. The people are too scared to complain or do anything about it.
And reconciliation in Rwanda. A new film takes stock of the country 15 years after the genocide.
We have rebuilt the roads, we've rebuilt the schools, we've rebuilt the hospitals. Rebuilding the hearts of people remains a big challenge. Forgiveness is not human, it's divine.
And the new African jazz of Somi. Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Fighting is still raging in Pakistan's Swat Valley. Hundreds of thousands of people have fled their homes. Many of them are living in makeshift camps south of the battle zone. Reporter Naheed Mustafa traveled to one of the largest camps just outside Peshawar and sent us this reporter's notebook.
The Kachagari camp sits on a huge open ground surrounded by Peshawar's bazaars. The sturdy white tents sit row after row. The rain's been pouring down for the past 4 days, and the ground beneath me is a sea of mud. The camp is divided by region of origin. This keeps family and tribal groups together, and also avoids conflict. Even though the people here all speak Pashto, are all Muslim and Pakistani, they don't like outsiders. I noticed that extended families living in several tents have strung up green tarp to surround their little group. The camp organizers call it a parda wall. It shields them, especially their women, from the roving eyes of strangers. There are nearly 7,000 people living here now. The newest residents are from Swat. I visited that region in my younger days. Growing up in Canada, it was always a special treat to spend summer vacation in Pakistan. People here will say you haven't seen nature's true beauty until you've seen Swat. And beautiful it was, with its towering mountains and deep valleys. But today the people of Swat, like those in the tribal belt, are fleeing the fighting. Taliban on one side, government forces on the other. Akhil Khan arrived here 3 months ago. He sits cross-legged on a folded quilt on the floor of his tent. When I walk in, he won't look at me. It's considered unseemly for men and women to look each other in the eye. But he moves over to make space for me on the quilt. He's from the village of Kumbar in Swat. He says Swat was beautiful, but after the Taliban came, everything was destroyed. He ran a shop but had to shut it down and now has nothing. But he hates being here too. He says life in Swat can never be what it was, but it's better than the life he has here in this camp. Akhil Khan shares his tent with 11 family members, including 5 grandchildren. But the tent is immaculate, and his grandchildren look like they've been spit-shined. I carry on to the other side of the camp and visit another family, this one from Bajor, in the semi-autonomous tribal belt. I'm welcomed inside the tent. While the mother, Muntaha, is comfortable being interviewed, her 16-year-old daughter, her own baby girl sitting firmly on her hip, doesn't want her mother to talk to me. She says it's immodest, that people outside the tent will hear her mother's voice. Mom goes ahead anyway. Muntaha says the fighting destroyed everything, and they had to leave under the cover of night, walking through the endless mountains. She says the Taliban attacked government forces and destroyed the hospital. She says the people are helpless. They can't influence the Taliban or the army, so they came here for safety. But the safety of these camps isn't guaranteed. During my time at Kachagari, I hear over and over again from the residents and some of the workers that there are Taliban in the camp. They came with their families and are exerting their influence. The people are too scared to complain or do anything about it. People continue to stream out of Swat, tens of thousands on a daily basis. They run here for sanctuary, for a little peace. But I wonder, if the Taliban follow them and set up shop here, where can these people possibly run to next?
Naheed Mustafa is a freelance journalist based in Toronto. Far from the fighting, hundreds of miles away in Karachi, life goes on as usual. Karachi is the commercial hub of Pakistan, a city of 14 million. People from all over the country go there to work in banking, law, and real estate. But many children work in Karachi as well, helping their parents put food on the table. Child labor is illegal in Pakistan, but those restrictions are widely ignored, and it's estimated up to 19 million children are in the workforce. Reporter Jessica Partnow spent a day with a child who's in a program that helps kids go to school while they work.
Shershah is a neighborhood on the outskirts of Karachi. Its narrow, dusty streets are crowded with tiny shops selling fresh-baked bread, auto parts, big blocks of ice, and scrap metal. Children work in almost every one of these shops. Nadeem Awan is one of them.
I wake up at 5:30 in the morning. I brush my teeth and wash, and then I go to the mosque. After prayers, I come home and have my breakfast. I leave home at about 6:45 to go to work.
Nadeem's standing one floor above the noisy machine shop where he works 10 hours a day. The 16-year-old has been working here full-time for 3 years. He and his younger brother, who works here too, bring in most of their family's income with a combined daily wage of about $1.50.
I just got a raise last week, so I earned 60 rupees per day. I receive my salary at the end of the month, and we use it to pay for the groceries we've bought on credit throughout the month.
He and three other boys use lathe machines to turn slugs of metal into nuts, bolts, hinges, and screws. Most of the parts are for tractors and other machinery. Nadeem wears a black t-shirt and sturdy work pants, but no safety goggles as he works. His face is serious as he guides a 3-inch cylinder of metal into the machine.
They give me a sample of a part, and then I make 200 or 250 copies of that sample. The other guys have to have lots of supervision, but I have experience, so I get to do things my own way. My boss just gives me an order, and I make the pieces.
He starts a large gear spinning and carefully shaves off bits of metal. A stream of water keeps it from getting too hot. Mubasher Zubair owns this shop and employs his own two sons here as well.
In Pakistan, our technical institutions are not that good. They don't really give students the practical skills they need. The best way for a young person to learn is by actually working in a shop.
He says he encourages all the children he employs to go to school.
Personally, I am more technically minded, but I want these kids to get an education as well. It is useful for my business that they have an education. I hope they stay and work for me for a long time.
Most working kids find it difficult to fit school in between long hours at the job. So a few years ago, the Sindh Education Foundation launched an unusual program to meet the needs of working children like Nadeem. Rather than forcing kids to choose between income and education, the program tries to offer them both. It runs a school that operates in shifts, three daily, each 3 hours long. That way, students can work before or after school. At 3 o'clock each day, Nadeem changes out of his work clothes and walks to a school that doesn't look like much. It's in a tall building in one of the winding, potholed alleyways that wander through Shershah. But as you climb the stairs, floor after floor reveals classrooms full of children studying. About half of the students here work. All the students in Nadeem's seventh grade class have jobs, collecting and sorting scrap metal, doing embroidery, or cooking and cleaning as servants. At 16, Nadeem is a few years behind for his age, but he's only been coming to school for the past 3 years. He says English is his favorite subject.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I am five brothers and two sisters.
Five brothers and two sisters, wow. Are you the oldest one?
Yes.
Nadeem smiles shyly as he talks to me. He's obviously proud of his work and his contribution to his family. And he gets a little time for fun each day.
After school, my friend and I walk together. We have some juice and talk a little bit and then go our own ways. We hang out for 10, 15 minutes and then they go home and I go back to work. I work from 6 until 9 p.m. I have my dinner, and then I help my father with his work before I go to sleep.
Nadim lives about a mile away in Liari, a neighborhood with a reputation for gang violence and crime. Sitting on the floor in the back room of their small, tidy house, Nadim's father, Mehboob, says he doesn't care where his son studies as long as he gets to go to school.
I don't want my son to suffer like I did, just roaming around in the streets. I want him to be able to work and study. I want him to have a better life.
Mehboob is proud of Nadim's education, but he hopes his son will decide to quit school after 10th grade so he can work longer hours. But Nadim plans to stick it out all the way through high school. When he graduates, he wants to open his own metal shop.
I want to keep working on a lathe machine. I want to have my own machine because you can make good money and even start saving.
To reach that goal, Nadim will wake up early tomorrow, wrestle his bicycle out the front door, and do it all again. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jessica Partnow in Karachi, Pakistan.
There's a slideshow of Nadim on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Funding for this report was provided by the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. And we head a little farther east now for this week's Globe at a Glance. In Nepal, farmers are coping with climate change. They're having to rethink what they plant every year. Erratic rainfall has damaged traditional crops like rice and maize. So some farmers are turning to crops that are more resilient, like bananas. Bananas grow easily in Nepal, and unlike other crops, they can survive without regular rainfall. Climate change experts attribute the changing weather patterns to global warming. The farmers don't care why the rains come late or not at all. They're simply concerned about putting food on the table. The farmers who switched to bananas have doubled their income. They're happy about that, but they're not happy about the erratic weather. It makes it difficult to plan important religious rituals that revolve around the rain. That's our Globe at a Glance. Coming up, 15 years after the genocide, reconciliation in Rwanda is still painful.
You may get people who live at peace together, but deep inside they are still harboring their anger and their bitterness, and that's not reconciliation. Out of 8 million people, how many have a testimony of forgiveness?
That's a scene from the documentary As We Forgive. We'll talk with a filmmaker after a short break. Stay with us.
Visage d'enfant, Tamara, au regard innocent. Musache wa yangu inofura Tamara, Tamara. Wino sachirazi mwinu tete, Tamara. Musache wa yangu inofura Tamara, Tamara. Wino sasimbiriera.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire.
If you take a country that 12 years ago was entrenched in the worst ethnic massacre.
We still have the reality of the genocide living with us, but we cannot wait until that is over to preach hope, to engage reconciliation, to rebuild the nation. We have to do it now.
We have rebuilt the roads, we've rebuilt the schools, we've rebuilt the hospitals, but rebuilding the hearts of people remain a big challenge.
Those are voices from the documentary As We Forgive. It's about the 1994 Rwandan genocide and how people reconciled in its wake. In just 100 days, almost 1 million Tutsis were slaughtered by Hutus. Many were their former friends and neighbors. After years of trials and convictions for the murders, Rwanda's prisons were bursting at the seams. So the government took a bold step. A decade after the mass killings, it released prisoners who had confessed their crimes, 50,000 of them. The hope was that these killers would reach out to their neighbors asking for forgiveness and that the victims would grant it, creating a nationwide movement of reconciliation. Laura Waters Henson was a graduate student doing volunteer work in Rwanda, and she witnessed this process, murderers asking for forgiveness from the very victims who had survived their attacks. Hinson was so moved by what she saw that she decided to document it in a film.
Coming to Rwanda for the first time, my only understanding of this country was one of a country ravaged by genocide. And when I arrived, I met a man named Bishop John Richihana, an Anglican bishop there, who told me a story of how he had reconciled with some of the people who had murdered, viciously murdered his family. And he told me that he wasn't the only one, that in fact Rwanda was beginning down a path of reconciliation after genocide, and that there were hundreds, maybe even thousands of people who were willing to confront their killers, and there were killers who were willing to repent and ask for forgiveness. Honestly, that completely blew me away. I wondered why I'd never heard about it, and I thought, it couldn't be a better topic for a documentary.
And the Rwandan government had released thousands of prisoners, and now they're living in the same neighborhoods many times with the very families they had butchered.
Exactly. I mean, it's the scenario is one that you couldn't even make up this stuff if you tried. The government in 2003, there was a huge backlog of court cases, incredible overcrowding in the prisons. President Kagame decided to release at one time about 40,000 killers. Those killers who had confessed and seemed to be repentant, and he sent them home to face the people in the villages whose families that they'd killed. It was a remarkable decision and pretty bold. I'm not sure just any president would do something like that.
How does a government foster reconciliation under such horrible conditions?
It's a good question. The government in Rwanda, began, I guess, publicly encouraging people to reconcile. They set up a local court system called the Gacaca court system, where instead of these perpetrators going through a federal trial, they would go back to their homes and face a court of their peers in their village. And these Gacaca trials are still being held all over the country, outside underneath trees in each village. They happen once a week. And the point of Gacaca was to allow the killers to come forward to confess to their community, and for the community to, if they were ready, to extend forgiveness to them. But it was a way of getting people back into their communities to publicly acknowledge what happened and to hear the stories so that people could begin to heal. So I would say the Gacaca court was the first step in the process of reconciliation. And then since then, I think the government has relied a lot on NGOs and churches and other institutions within civil society to then help truly reintegrate people, these killers, back into their communities.
And this is some of what your film showed. You followed several characters through this difficult process of reconciliation. There's Chantal and John, John being the man who killed Chantal's father. You filmed them coming together for the first time since he had murdered her father. What were their lives like, and how did this episode affect their day-to-day living?
Chantal, she was one of the most raw individuals that I met in Rwanda. Most Rwandans are quite stoic, don't show a lot of emotion. Chantal was visibly destroyed by the genocide. She had lost almost every family member, at least 30 family members, and it showed on her face, in her body language. She immediately broke down and wept when she began to talk about it. And you would think, oh, it's been 14 years. No, this pain was just on the surface of her soul, of her being, even when I met her in 2006. Her life was destroyed. She was a bitter, broken woman, full of rage and anger. In all ways, she was devastated by the genocide.
How about John? What did he tell you?
Well, what's interesting is that I really thought that when I met the killers that I would just have abject hate for them, that I wouldn't be able to relate to them. And yet when I met John, I saw also a man who was totally broken by what he had done. I don't know that he is representative of all the killers, but John in particular was incredibly ashamed by his killing. He said he couldn't even explain what had come over him, but that now he lived a life of shame, because he said the thing that bothered him most was that now his children were known as the children of a murderer. And so he lives kind of out on the outskirts of town where he was kind of hiding from the rest of the world.
What happened when they first met each other? How did Chantal handle that?
Oh, I had no idea what was going to happen when John walked into the room. It was this moment of incredible tension. But he walked into the room with the most humble, sort of sad look on his face, his shoulders slumped. And he walked up to Chantal and he extended his hand to her. And they both greeted one another with the handshake, which is the handshake of respect. And I was blown away that she would shake his hand with that physical sign. But he proceeded to then confess to her how he killed her father, why he did it, and then how sorry he was for doing it. And then Chantal was able to reply with a great amount of anger, understandably. She said, you've ruined my life. The government has pardoned you. Why do you want forgiveness from me? What does it matter to you? You're living with your family and your kids and your wife, and I'm here with nothing. Why does it matter to you that I forgive you? It was intense. She let him have it in all senses of the word. And ultimately, she said in the end, I can't forgive you today. I'm praying to God that he gives me the strength to forgive you one of these days.
You've been back since you filmed that documentary, and you've checked on both of them. What's happened since then?
I got word about 6 months or so after I originally shot the film that Chantal went through a more intensive reconciliation workshop with John, and that after about 6 months, she decided to forgive him. I really couldn't believe it. I mean, I'd seen her anger and her dismay and despair over this man, and I thought there was personally no hope. But I went back a couple of weeks ago and I showed them the film. And then I said, please tell me why you decided to forgive. And she began to describe how she felt that God and her community had helped give her the strength to release him and that it wasn't up to her any longer, his punishment. She said that she felt incredible freedom and that her whole life, honestly, had turned around and changed because this burden on her of anger and bitterness was gone. And she told the story sitting side by side with John. And the look on both of their faces was so radically different than the look on their faces 2.5 years ago. I couldn't believe it. I sat there and I wept and I wept.
And this is exactly the kind of thing you were trying to document in your film. How would you describe, Laura, what it is you were trying to capture in your documentary to show not just the people of Rwanda, but people here in the United States?
Well, I wanted to show that reconciliation after something like genocide, which we can't even imagine, most of us, that it's possible and that it's having an incredible transformational effect on the people of Rwanda, that it's beginning slowly to heal people's hearts and their lives and their communities. I also wanted to show that it's a process. That's why I chose the title As We Forgive. It's not just a one-time decision you make and then your life is better. No, this is a daily decision that people make day after day, week after week, month after month to forgive the killers.
How successful has it been bringing people like Chantal and John together? Are they in the minority?
I would say that the general population at least pays lip service to the idea of reconciliation. Most Rwandans would say that it's a good thing. I think there are a lot of people with a lot of hurt and sadness who haven't voiced their anger against the killers. But I think there are more and more who are truly forgiving. It's hard. There's not a lot of literature or, quantifiable evidence of how successful it's been. I mean, I can say that Rwanda today is one of the most peaceful countries in Africa. It's one of the least corrupt countries in Africa with the lowest violent crime rate. So it's made unbelievable progress since the genocide. So on that level, I would say it's done amazingly well.
Your documentary has recently won a Student Academy Award for Best Documentary. You were doing this during your master's thesis. But I understand that you've gotten an even bigger invitation, and that's from the Rwandan government. Where is this film going?
Yeah, this is what I'm working on full time now, which is so exciting. I received a grant from the John Templeton Foundation recently to do an outreach campaign with the movie in Rwanda. And President Kagame and the Rwandan government, their Ministry of Education, their Ministry of Culture, they're all working with me and my team to do a tour of As We Forgive throughout the country, to show the film and then do follow-up work and facilitate dialogues about forgiveness in each of the communities where we show the film. So we're going to be taking the movie to the prisons in Rwanda. The Ministry of Education wants it shown in all Rwandan schools and universities. We'll be showing it in villages where there's not even electricity. And the goal is to really help the Rwandans, especially those who have not voiced their experience and their bitterness and all of these big issues, to give them a chance to have that dialogue in their community.
I bet you never could have imagined when you started out doing this. I think there were just two or three of you. And didn't you edit this on your Mac computer that it would end up like this?
No, Peggy, this is like the biggest shocker of my life. This was just a student film. Yet I think the concept and the topic of radical forgiveness is something that has captured a lot of people's imaginations. And I feel so passionately about telling Rwanda's story. I love this idea that in this country where the worst atrocities occurred that you can imagine, that now there's hope arising in such an incredible way. Like, people just can't square in their minds how a place known for genocide can now be a place known for forgiveness.
Laura Waters Hinson, director of As We Forgive, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
This month, many PBS stations will air Hinson's documentary. The filmmaker has also created a way for Americans to get involved in the reconciliation process. To find out more, check our website, worldvisionreport.org. El Ciruelo may look like just another poor Mexican fishing village, but if you look again, you'll see that most of the villagers are black. They're descendants of slaves brought here 300 years ago. The Mexican slave trade, which was abolished in 1829, was very small. Maybe that's why it's been all but forgotten, even by its descendants. Conrad Fox reports.
On his dry, scrubby farm, Adan Banos is feeding his dozen or so cattle. I offer to help unload the bags of feed that are laced with chicken manure for nutrients, but he says no thanks. You'll get so smelly, not even black people will want to be with you. And then he laughs, embarrassed. It's not just that he realizes how offensive this sounds, it's because Banos himself is black. Banos's tight curly hair, tall build and dark skin clearly reveal his African heritage. I ask him what he thinks of those roots.
No, nunca, ni hasta ahorita. No, nunca.
Well, I don't know anything about that. Growing up, we never thought about being black. I mean, we knew we were black just by looking at ourselves, at our skin. But what can I say? This is the first time I heard that. If we're from Africa, well, cool.
In fact, little is known about Mexico's black population. Estimates range from 50 to 500,000, mostly scattered throughout the country's southern states, in communities so remote, most Mexicans have never heard of them. Father Glenn Gemmett is the Catholic priest for El Ciruelo. He's a native of Trinidad, but came to work here 25 years ago to minister to Mexico's blacks. He says it's not surprising that people like Banos know nothing about their past. He compares the situation of black Mexicans to the country's other minority, indigenous people.
The Indian is closer to his past than the African is. But for both, the destruction did take place. The difference is that even though at some time the empire put a building, a Catholic church, on top of their pyramids and destroyed their temples and their monuments, they still have a stone that they can go back to. and point to. Blacks do not.
But Jamet hopes to bring the past back to life for Afro-Mexicans. A group of young men dance to the music of a harmonica and a cow's jaw rasped with a stick. They're dressed in furs and terrifying-looking masks. Audience members are dragged into the convulsing fray and whipped across the legs if they refuse. It looks painful, but it's done with good humor. This dance is being held in the rec center of a town near El Ciruelo. Its origins lie in dances brought from Africa by slaves, but it's been dying out in recent generations. Today, it forms part of a dance festival organized by Father Jemet to promote Afro-Mexican culture among local black communities. The effort seems to be paying off.
Porque soy negro. Le digo yo que sí, me gusta mi color porque soy negro.
That's Tirso Salinas, one of the concert spectators. He said that outside his community, people don't believe he's Mexican because of his skin color. But he doesn't care.
No vamos a hacer la de Michael Jackson.
I'm not going to do what Michael Jackson did, pay myself with milk to get rid of my color. If you're black, you should love yourself that way. That's how God made us.
On this night, many others seem to share the same pride. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in El Ciruelo, Oaxaca, Mexico.
That's Somi with her take on African jazz. We'll have more a little later on the World Vision Report.
Day was hot and danced with sunshine. Early June and Gemini's moon. Destined to escape the corners of the red and sheltered moon. I
We're back with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. The election in India is over, and many are waiting to see what the new government will bring. The Dalits, who used to be called untouchables, are watching closely. During the campaign, many politicians promised to improve the lives of the Dalits. That would be good news for people like Lake Ram. He's a Dalit who collects recyclables for a living. Here's Mary Stuckey with the latest in our Street Vendor series.
For Lake Ram, this morning started like every other morning for the past 20 years. He rings the doorbell of a second-floor apartment on a busy street and tells the owner that he's interested in buying her trash. In particular, he's looking for newspapers, bottles, plastic, and scrap metal.
Newspaper, akhbar, plastic, loya, yes, scrap.
He'll just weigh them, and according to the weight, he'll pay.
Ram explains to the woman that he'll pay her not just according to weight, but also quality. For instance, English language newspapers are printed on higher quality paper, so he pays more for them. Lake Ram puts what he's bought into bags and carries them outside to his bicycle. It's got hooks attached to it from which to hang his bundles. He pedals off to his little shop about four blocks away.
I've gotten used to it, and the weight doesn't bother me anymore.
The open-air shop measures barely 6 feet square and sits on a crowded street, an astrologer on one side, a shoemaker on the other. It's stuffed full, and everything needs to be sorted. Paper in one pile, metal in another, heavy plastic separated from the lighter kind. Ram sells this stuff to middlemen who come to his shop about once a month. They in turn sell to bigger recycling operations. It's an efficient process in a country where nothing is wasted and almost everything has some value. Ram is called a Ruddiwala, which means loosely, one who collects throwaway stuff. He makes about $4 a day, just barely enough to give his three children more options than he had.
Children
For me, happiness comes when my child gets good grades or does good things.
Ram doesn't look like someone who spends his days sorting trash with his neatly combed jet black hair and well-pressed trousers. But he is what used to be called an untouchable, the lowest caste in India, now called Dalits. Traditionally, Dalits were relegated to the most distasteful jobs, cleaning latrines, working in tanneries, that's what Lake Ram's father did, or collecting trash. These jobs were considered unclean, and those who did them were social outcasts. But Rams has given his lack of education and his caste, it was the only job he could find.
I'm not afraid of hard work. Everybody should work hard, and my earnings are coming as a result of hard work. I'm not stealing. I'm working hard for my kids, and so for me, everything is okay.
Ram hopes his children will graduate from high school, maybe even college. Dalits still suffer discrimination, especially in rural India, but times are changing. Now, thanks to affirmative action, places are reserved for the lowest castes in government jobs and university admissions.
The poor in India have suffered, but now the government is making life just a little bit easier than in earlier times.
As I left Lake Ram in his shop, he was hoping someone might come by with a load of trash. That sometimes happens. In the meantime, he returns to sorting, with the hope that he will be the last in his family to work as a Radiwala. For the World Vision Report, I'm Mary Stuckey in Ambala, India.
Benedict called for greater respect for women on his recent trip to the Middle East. The Sisters of the Good Shepherd would endorse that call. The nuns work with women and children in trouble in Damascus, Syria. Will Everett visited the nuns in their convent and sent us this reporter's notebook.
Sister Evangeline is a tiny elderly woman with sharp blue eyes. She's one of a handful of European nuns, the Sisters of the Good Shepherd, who work on behalf of Iraqi refugees in Damascus. I wanted to do a story on the mental health services they offer to Iraqi children to help them through their wartime experiences. Sister Evangeline seemed friendly enough when we corresponded prior to my arrival at her convent, but when I got there, something had changed. She seemed remote and preoccupied. She delayed our interview several times, then canceled it altogether. These are heroic women who work in the poorest slums, but I found that there was an even more heroic side to the work of these aged nuns. They were now offering their small convent as a shelter for battered Iraqi wives with nowhere else to go. The problem was, enraged husbands were showing up at all hours demanding the return of their wives. Just the week before, a drunken Iraqi man had gotten inside and torn up the place while the terrified nuns barricaded themselves in a storeroom. So Sister Evangeline patiently explained to me the importance of their keeping a low profile. This meant they'd no longer be talking to journalists. I pleaded with her, but she wouldn't budge. "No interview," she said again and again. She poured tea, and we talked at length about the problems facing women in Syria and the Middle East. Sister Evangeline had made it her life's work to help relieve their suffering. She was moved to tears as she talked about the need for action on behalf of women. It was a stirring speech, as rendered by my translator. The most pressing problem, she felt, was the lack of news getting to America and Europe on the plight of Arab women. I said that if people like herself who know about the problem firsthand won't give interviews, how will the West find out? She thought about this and told me to turn on my recorder.
يا صديقي حقوق المرأة هي في شرعة الأمم المتحدة هي من حقوق الإنسان.
This is a message for the people of America. Wake up, she said. Stop talking about women's rights and start doing something about it. The treaties and international agreements aren't enough. Come here and make a difference. Help us end the humiliation these women are facing. This went on for several minutes. Women continue to face humiliation and disrespect, particularly in the Arab world, she said. Women here in Damascus were being imprisoned in their own homes by jealous husbands, and there were no laws to protect them. At the end, she said, I know the American people. Once they know the truth, they'll do something about it. The speech seemed to have softened her up, so I went in for one last try. I said, "You can help the American people understand the problems facing Iraqi women through your work. Let's do that interview." But at that, her face hardened and she wagged one crooked finger in my face. "No interviews," she said. Sister Evangeline went off to help another nun who was calling for her behind a closed door. My translator said there was nothing more to be done here. We gathered our things and drifted out into the noisy Damascus night, closing the heavy convent doors on the sisters and their secret.
Will Everett is a freelance reporter and producer based in Texas.
Ruhanga kulimbe.
Somi is a jazz musician who uses her music to explore her African roots. Somi's parents come from East Africa, but she was born and raised in the U.S. Her music reflects that mix of cultures and languages. She sings in four of them. Somi calls her style New African Jazz and Soul. You can hear it here in the title track of her latest album, Red Soil in My Eyes.
Ancestors are calling. I can see acacia trees bathing in the river Nile, echoes of my mother's smile.
So pretty. Somi, welcome to the show. Tell us a little, if you would, about this song and what it's about.
Well, Red Soil in My Eyes, really it's about my journey of looking to home. I'm originally from Uganda and Rwanda, but I grew up mostly in the States, in Illinois. And it's really about looking to home, looking to that part of the world, to East Africa, looking to the rhythms, the culture, the music, the stories, the language, and trying to find a sense of clarity and a sense of myself in the music.
Dancing girls with amber in their
hair. Now, you've often said that your music represents a whole new African experience. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that what's happening is there's a huge generation, a huge community now of Africans who have been born and raised abroad, who may have been born even in Africa, but then lived most of their lives in the West and have this new African identity. And myself, I'm an African woman who also has a very strong American identity. Part of what I'm trying to do is say that, you know, it doesn't really matter where you're from, whether I'm from Africa or from Europe or from Asia or from wherever, Latin America, or from here. The point is that everybody comes with a story and nobody can really sort of fit into this box.
Now, your mother's from Uganda, your father is from Rwanda. They were over here to get educated and you ended up living mostly here, but obviously, you've gone back and forth to Africa, and you say that that experience has really affected your music. What would I hear in your music that illustrates that experience? What would we be listening for?
Well, hopefully you would hear a story of two worlds. Hopefully you'd hear a story of two cultural influences and sort of what it is to live in between and within both of those cultures. And So hopefully you'd hear some references to like classic American soul and traditional jazz. And then also hopefully you'd hear a lot of the stories of home, of our home in East Africa and hear some of the rhythms. And obviously linguistically, I do sing in a few of the languages in that region.
And I think it'd be fair to say that your song Ngele from the album Red Soil in My Eyes is a good example of that, because you sound like an American jazz singer, but you're actually singing in Swahili. Your mom is from Uganda, and you love Uganda. You've been back there and lived there for a while. But you have a lot to say, and not necessarily positive things, about the role of women in Uganda and how women are treated there. What is it that you talk about when you speak about women there?
Well, it's not so much that I have a lot of negative things to say about how women are treated. I think that women are doing phenomenal things in Uganda. But there are certain policies that are still in place, certain laws that are still in place that are, I think, are incredibly sexist. And one of those issues is that a man still has the right to beat his wife because technically she's considered his property. And if she's to leave him, then she loses her children. He has, you know, there's no, she doesn't have any sort of, she has no rights.
Well, you actually wrote a song, Somi, about this topic called African Lady, and it was a response to your frustration about domestic violence in Uganda. It's also a remake of the song Lady by Nigerian singer Fela Kuti. His song was rather derogatory toward women in a way, and yours is just the opposite. It's speaking up for women, taking the stereotypes away.
Well, his song Lady, I love Fela, but that song Lady isn't so nice to the ladies, right? And he sort of speaks about all these stereotypes of African women, and I thought that I should say something, you know, that was sort of a reclamation of power. I mean, the only thing that's really the same is the chorus, the melody of the chorus. I sort of reference it in my chorus, and that it's Afrobeat.
Don't you know, with a fist your love don't show. Take my hand, let's leave this valley. Use your strength and love to guide me. I'm your lady, I'll be your queen. Try to harm me, you'll hear me scream. I gon' say I'll be lady, oh.
Now, you, Somi, you talk a lot about your mother in your music, I assume. She's also has been a great inspiration to you, so much so that you even wrote a song about her called Mbabazi. What does the title mean?
The title is her name, and it means peace in my language, my father's language, Kinyarwanda. And it's just a story about a hardworking woman and a woman who loves just as hard as she works.
Are you up for singing a few lines from it for us?
Sure.
Somi, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your music with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
is African jazz singer Somi. And that brings us to the end of our show. If you want to know more about our program or any of the stories we featured on the show, check out our website. The address again, worldvisionreport.org. We have a link there so you can podcast the show and listen to it whenever you want. We also have blogs from our reporters around the world. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Our assignment editor is Lita Hartman. Our producers are Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Susan Shepherd. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. Larry Short is our interactive editor. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.